Welcome to Text Messages. These recommendations for teen readers are produced by ReadWriteThink.org, a partnership between the National Council of Teachers of English and the International Reading Association.
This is episode 79 of Text Messages, a conversation with Candace Fleming. I'm your host, Jennifer Bueller. New nonfiction books for teens rarely get the kind of attention and airtime we devote to novels. And yet, in the world of young adult literature, some of today's best and most powerful stories are being told by authors of nonfiction. Candace Fleming is one of those authors. Her newest book, The Family Romanov, Murder, Rebellion, and the Fall of Imperial Russia, is both a portrait of Russia's last royal family and a look at the causes of revolution. It's a book about flawed leaders, the restless masses, and the consequences when a ruling class turns a blind eye to the struggles of the poor. It's an examination of the past, and it's a cautionary tale for today. If you come to this book, as I did, with little or no background knowledge, you'll get a rich tutorial in Russian history. But you'll also be challenged to think about our current world. How is today's wealth gap the same or different from the wealth gap in Tsarist Russia? How should political leaders respond in the face of civic unrest? How are the fates of the powerful and the powerless intertwined? But there's more than history here. When you read The Family Romanov, you'll encounter complex characters, evocative settings, and page-turning suspense. The very same story elements that draw readers into a great novel are at work in this book. When I turned the last page, I wanted to know more. I was lucky enough to interview Candace Fleming at the NCTE Annual Convention in National Harbor, Maryland. In this episode, you'll hear about how and why she wrote The Family Romanov. You'll also hear about research as a process of questioning, how empathy plays a role in historical storytelling, and how authors of nonfiction are pushing the envelope in books for today's teens. I began our interview, as I often do, by asking Candace about the origins of this book. In an offhand aside, she referred to The Family Romanov as the Monster Project. I asked her why she described the book that way.
I started the project because I would go and talk to middle schoolers, and I would talk to them about other people I'd written about, Eleanor Roosevelt, Amelia Earhart, and I would have question and answer time. And always, I'm not kidding, invariably, some girl would raise her hand, and she would want to know about Anastasia Romanov. And I would tell them what I knew, which, you know, I thought was considerable because I had read some things. But, you know, you can only tell them so much in a five-minute answer, and it's question and answer time. And I got to the point where I thought, why is it that they keep asking me this? And I realized that it was that Anastasia, the animated movie. And I think that middle schoolers, I believe this, they knew that that was based on a nugget of truth, and yet they couldn't dig out what that nugget of truth actually was. And I really believe that middle schoolers and high schools, they really are interested in truth. They really want to know the truth. I think that's one of their, you know, has to be true. I really believe that veracity is important to them. So I thought, fine, I'm going to write a story about her. I'm going to write her true story. I'm going to answer their question. And so, and this sounds so silly, I thought to myself, it'll be a simple project. I'm going to write this little fluffy piece about Anastasia, quick, and she only lived 16 years, and I know it's got a bad ending, but, you know, I'm going to write this story. And I did enough research to quickly discover that there really wasn't much of a story. I mean, she wasn't particularly interesting. She wasn't a girl that had a lot of interesting hobbies. You know, she wasn't beautiful like we've always been told. She wasn't well-educated like we've always been told. And I thought, well, all right, her story, maybe I won't tell her story. Maybe I'll add the sisters in. That'll add something. And I go and do the research, and guess what I discovered? That the sisters themselves, not particularly interesting, not a lot of hobbies, not a lot there. So then I think Alexei, I'll add him in, it'll be all the kids, same thing. And so the project grew. I mean, it just grew and grew and grew. And that's why I call it the Monster Project, because it became a much bigger project. The research ended up leading to more research, which ended up to more questions, which had more research, which became another question. It became this unbelievably big project, which I had not expected. I did not expect 65,000 words and 300 pages. I was looking, seriously, 64 pages. I know. Yes, my editor, Ann Schwartz. I kept calling her and going, I have a new idea now. I need to expand this idea just a little bit. So,
how did she respond to those shifts?
She's used to me. Oh, she said, oh, we're going to do this now. Okay. All right. Okay.
As I listened to Candace talk, something that stood out to me was how it was the process of asking questions that led her further and further into this project. I had heard her say in another interview that when you're doing research, you have to ask the right question to get to the next level. I asked Candace to speak a little bit about the sorts of questions that were coming up for her as she realized the story was going to have more and more layers.
When I went to Russia, and I always try to go to the places that the story took place, and I went to Russia, and I went to Circus Salo, the Imperial Park where the family lived, and all the primary source material that I had read over the past 2 years, the previous 2 years, had talked about how they had sort of retired and they had this sort of endless tea party out there 15 miles from St. Petersburg, away from the seat of government, at this big park, and they were away from the people. So they didn't see them. They didn't have any communication with them. And so I got this sense that the Alexandra Palace was in the middle of the park and that there was green Imperial Park all the way around and that they saw no one. When I went, I went to the palace, and I realized that the palace gates, you open the palace gates, and you walk up a circular driveway to the front door of the palace. And when you go to the side that the Romanovs actually lived on, it faces that fence. And on the other side, directly on the other side of the fence, is a town. So they would have heard them every day. They would have smelled their cooking. They would have heard the animals. And so they were not separated from the people the way that the sources indicated that they had been separate, like physically separated from their people, but they weren't. So all of a sudden I thought, my God, it was a psychological separation and I don't really understand that. And I can remember standing on the opposite side of those palace gates, literally standing there holding those bars, looking across the street into the town and thinking they were really literally right here. They were part of their everyday existence. So why was there no attachment? Was there no connection? I don't understand that. And that led to an entire different chain of questions. I mean, it was something I had never really questioned before. You know, I had always assumed that they had isolated themselves physically, but it really was a psychological isolation. So why?
One of the most memorable things about Candace's approach to the Romanov story is that she ended up weaving together the voices of peasants, workers, and soldiers, those people on the other side of the palace gates, with the story of the Romanovs themselves. Even though it's clear that the Romanovs were terrible rulers who willingly blinded themselves to the suffering of the people, there's a way in which readers can feel sympathy for them. I told Candace that I was struck from the beginning by how Nicholas was utterly unprepared to inherit the throne from his father. He didn't want to rule Russia, but he had to. And so while I found him and his family members to be contemptible, I also felt sorry for them. I asked Candace how she approached writing the Romanovs as characters so they would come across as more than just the bad guys.
Oh, I was so worried about that because... Well, let's take Alex. I feel, you know, Alex, my friend Alex. I wouldn't have her for a friend, but I remember, you know, when I started out, I was contemptible. I have to say that I thought she was contemptible, and I had, you know, I thought, oh, you know, what was she thinking? You could be, you know, there were times I wanted to reach in and shake her, but I also understand her on so many levels. I mean, I understand what she was trying to do with her family. I'm a mother, right? So I understand that need to make this little nest out there in the Imperial Park away from everyone else. I am shy at times. So I understand that uncomfortable, shy feeling. I understand Nick in many ways, that you know, he didn't want to do this. He just wanted to be left alone. Who doesn't want to be just left alone with their family? Who hasn't had that experience themselves in their own day-to-day life where you think, I do not want to deal with this today. I just want to be left alone in my house. I just want to be with my kids, my family. I don't want to deal with life, right? So who hasn't had that? And then you think to yourself, in many ways, they didn't even choose this. This is, they were born to it, you know, so it wasn't a choice. They're unbelievably complex, and yet I found myself unbelievably sympathetic, especially towards the end of their lives, because we can say they've made bad decisions. We can say they're bad rulers when they were. We can say they were thoughtless and that they were blind and purposefully blind, obviously, when we know how close they were to those people in town. But we can also say that they're human beings. So we know that human beings are flawed, that they make bad choices, that they loved each other, that they loved their family. And I think that's what makes their family, their story so very poignant, is the fact that you can connect with those, with the humanity of them.
Candace went on to explain that connecting with the humanity of the Romanovs presented a particular writing challenge. As she noted earlier, we come to the book knowing that their story ends badly. They're murdered, and their deaths mark a turning point in world history. And yet writing the actual scene of their killing proved to be very difficult.
I remember, you know, writing the end of that story, and every day I would write a day in July, and I knew what was coming. We all know what's coming. And I remember writing it with this unbelievable sense of dread, and even thinking to myself, I wonder if I can get around it, if I don't have to show that last scene, if I could actually not write that last scene, it would be much better for me if I don't have to shoot those children, you know, those beautiful children or that nice dog or even, you know, Nicholas and Alexandra. By this point, I have a real sympathy for them, you know. Wouldn't it be nice if I could get around to not writing this last scene? And I tried not to, actually. And everyone I talked to said, you have to. Readers particularly are obsessed with the fact that perhaps someone escaped, and we know no one escaped. And so you're going to have to be very definite with that last scene. And so I must have written it 10 times, probably, trying to find the right balance, what details to use, what not to be too horrifying, but to still make you feel the horribleness, you know. So it was inevitable, I think. In many ways, it was brought on by their own actions. I believe that if they'd given just a few inches, that it possibly would not have happened. So what happened in that basement is many ways brought on by their own actions. And yet, I didn't want my readers to go, well, you got what you deserved, you know, because it is still, it's a terrible thing.
Something I wondered as I read The Family Romanov was whether and how authors who write about famous events in history can make familiar material new. Given that many other scholars have written about the Communist Revolution and the fall of the Romanovs, I asked Candace how she went about creating something new as she worked with this material.
When you're writing history, at least for me, you're not just rehashing a bunch of facts. You make the history your own. Because you're recreating a world. And I always refer to it as my vital idea. I don't know what other people call it, but for my own self, I say to myself, what is my vital idea? The reason I'm telling you this history, if it's the Lincolns or if it's the Romanovs or if it's Ben Franklin, people you think you know or people you've never heard of before, what is it that I want to say with my this story? What is it I'm trying to say? What am I adding to the conversation? And so there's a real reason that I'm telling you this particular story, and it really has to do with my point of view, right? So I'm going to choose the theme. It really is very close to writing fiction, although I'm staying as close as I am to the truth. I mean, I'm staying true to my sources. I'm staying as true as I can to other viewpoints within the limitations of knowledge. So I'm staying true to that. And yet, in many ways, it's like I'm writing my own. It's like writing fiction because it's my history. I'm recreating it, and I have something to say with it. And I think that's what makes it individual and what makes it different from other things that you end up reading. I think in the case of the family Romanov, it's about the addition of those ordinary Russians. I mean, that's a part of the story that when you read other people's histories of the Romanovs, you maybe get a glimpse of, oh, there's a revolution brewing out there and Lenin turns up, but you never really hear about the lives of those ordinary Russians. You never really hear about how difficult it was, how in many ways that revolution was inevitable. You know, nobody was listening, nobody was noticing. And you've got millions of people that really need to live a decent life. It's inevitable. And I could have just told you, the reader, about their lives, but I thought it was more poignant and more immediate if you could actually hear them tell their own stories.
Of course, in order to do something new in writing history, an author needs to have deep understanding of the history she's writing. I wanted to know how Candace developed the kind of background knowledge necessary to write this book. She explained that she couldn't have done it without the help of Mark Steinberg, a Russian scholar at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Not only did Steinberg fact-check her work, he gave her a tutorial in Russian history. I was amazed to hear about the time and care Steinberg devoted to her project.
He would send me 16-page emails. Seriously, I would send him my manuscript, and he sent me a 16-page email with 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I mean, it must have been 60 points. Sometimes he would simply say, where did you get that? Where did you get that? Where did you get that quote? And I had sent him all my source material. You know, I had sent him the bibliography that I was using, which was vast, and I thought pretty great. And he agreed that it was pretty great. Is it a quote from Lenin? I wish I could remember the exact quote. But he said, where did you get that? And I knew where I'd gotten it. And he actually came back and he said, you know what? That is not, I know everybody uses that source, but that's not, it's a questionable source. And I said, oh, it's a questionable source. Well, then I've used da, 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 and da. You know, there were other ones that I'd used. And he actually substituted another book for it. More recent scholarship, better scholarship. And so I made a lot of changes based on that. Oftentimes I would come back and I say, well, I don't understand. What's the subtlety? What you're saying and what I'm saying, I feel are the same thing. And he'd say, not exactly. And then I'd get a tutorial, seriously, a tutorial in Russian history. He was not, that book is only as good as it is because of him. He was truly worried about what young readers were getting. He's an amazing man.
Candace is one of a number of authors who's showing us new possibilities in nonfiction writing for teens. When I asked how conversations with fellow authors inform her thinking about her own books, she said they've helped her push the envelope in writing nonfiction. I asked her what she meant by that phrase.
Is that everybody's telling stories now. So we're no longer fact tellers, which is, an amazing thing in itself. But we're all telling stories, and they're nuanced stories, and they're stories that aren't just about, if you're telling the life of Ben Franklin, it's no longer just about Ben Franklin. It's about so much more. Those are things we didn't used to do. I think we think about the readers. I think we introduce subjects that we used to think no one would be interested in, or no one would want to read about, or no one wants to do a report about, and therefore, why bother to write it? And we're looking at nonfiction now like fiction, at least I hope we are, in the sense that, it's a book we're writing so that someone will simply read, and not just use for a report, so we're going to take some essential facts out of. You look at design, you look at font, you look at, I really think it's like the creative edge of children's publishing right now. The things that we're doing in design, the things that expand the information, the stories that are in the story, in the book that we've expanded with photographs. And, I just think it's just an astonishing place to be. It's really exciting. And the things that we can tell children that I think 10 years ago we could never. I mean, could you ever have written like that scene in the basement with the Romanovs? I think 10 years ago, I'm not sure you could have really done that.
Why?
sure why, but it feels like we've really expanded, that we've opened up, that we're being a lot more honest with kids about the world. And we don't have to present it ugly. I don't have to say this is a horrible ugliness, but there is a truth to it. And maybe that's it. Maybe nonfiction has just become more truthful, not in the sense that the facts are more true, but that our approach to it is more honest. You know, here's this real true story, and here are these people, and we might have think they're heroes, but they have some warts. They have some flaws, and they're just like you and I. They're human. And, you know, maybe that's it.
Candace added that pushing the envelope in writing nonfiction for teens involves design choices as well as choices about storytelling and truthfulness. As an example, she said that her editor, Anne Schwartz, initially wanted The Family Romanoff to look like other nonfiction books for young readers. She planned to fill it with sidebars and photos throughout. But Candace wanted something different, based on her sense of her readers and the nature of the material.
Middle grade and high schoolers kept telling me that they wanted nonfiction that looked like their fiction, that they didn't want it that looked like a textbook. And I think fourth graders need a text that's interspersed with photos still. But middle schoolers and high schools didn't want that anymore. And the more I thought about it, I thought, why not? Because if we write a novel, we don't throw a bunch of pictures in there for middle school and high school. We let their imagination roam, right? We let them conjure up the world in their imagination, and the writer does enough work to let them do that. So why don't we do that with nonfiction? Why not let them, why can it be an imaginative process? That if I, as the writer, do my work and I've recreated enough of this world, you can see it in your head. You don't really need to see a picture of the inside of the Winter Palace, right? So, no, that's my hope. We'll see if that's we'll see if that really works. But, you know, that was the hope.
One of the most powerful things I took from my interview with Candace Fleming is the idea that you write the book that needs to be written, and you worry about audience later. Still, Candace admitted that she sometimes felt daunted when she paused to think about who might ultimately read this complex and ambitious work. I'll leave you with her thoughts on the answer to this question.
I remember at one point I said to, it was Anne Schwartz, my editor, I said to her, this is a book that I thought I was writing for 14-year-old girls about a grand duchess, basically a princess, right? I'm just writing a princess story. And I said, suddenly this has become a very muscular book in many ways. There's no way around that. It's become about a revolution. It's become about, you know, a war. It's become about politics. It's become about Russian history. It's much more than a little girl's life. And I was a little paralyzed. I said to her, here's the question, who's going to read this? At the end of the day, I thought, who in the world will want to read this? But you know, my answer to that, of course, is if I do my job, everybody should want to read this.
I hope you will read this book and recommend it to the teens in your life. The Family Romanoff should be available at your local library or bookstore. Remember that no book is right for every reader, so preview books for appropriate reading level and content before passing them on to your teen. Next month, I'll be back with a special episode about the Allen Workshop, also known as the Assembly on Literature for Adolescents of NCTE. Allen is an organization that's dedicated to young adult literature and the reading lives of teens. Its mission comes to life at the annual workshop, held after the NCTE convention on the Monday and Tuesday before Thanksgiving. Tune in to hear highlights from this year's workshop, along with testimonials from attendees about what they find and why they go. Until next time, I'm Jennifer Bueller.
More episodes of Text Messages are available at www.readwritethink.org/textmessages. You can listen to our elementary book podcast, Chatting About Books, at www.readwritethink.org/chattingaboutbooks. Text Messages is supported by the Verizon Foundation through thinkfinity.org and produced monthly by the National Council of Teachers of English and the International Reading Association. Music in this podcast is courtesy of Scott Andrew. Thanks for listening, and look forward to more text messages soon.